Welcome, listeners, to a long-expected episode of Riddles in the Dark, the premier internet sensation podcast on all things Tolkien, specifically The Hobbit. If you're only listening to one thing downloaded off the internet, it should be this. You know, all those NPR podcasts you listen to, don't bother. There you go. Was that grand enough for you guys?
That was great. I'm pulling that out as a soundbite.
That's right. Ringtone. So we're finally getting to a topic that I think has been hotly anticipated, certainly by us and probably by the listeners, and that is, of course, the encounter with the spiders in the shadows of Mirkwood. And we're pretty excited about this because I think even dating back to probably 2011, there's been hints and speculations about this because we've seen trailer footage and images of Legolas with his bow drawn in sort of shadowy forest areas. So people are anticipating big changes, maybe some shield surfing, maybe some non-canonical Toriel action. So
As opposed to the canonical Toriel action.
Yes. So we're primed and ready to get into it. So I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me, as always, are my wonderful co-hosts, Trish Lambert, and the illustrious Tolkien professor, Corey Olson. Good morning.
Whoa.
Good morning. So, yes,
I'm
we have...
I'm completely awe-stricken now. Between this being a premier podcast and Corey being illustrious, I'm just, like, you know, humbled.
Yeah. Well, anyway, yes, good morning. Hello. So, yes, it is true. This is a subject that we have been trying to prevent ourselves from discussing for a long time. We have been wanting to jump forward to this and keep stopping ourselves, more or less. So very good. Well, first, before we actually start our discussion of Hobbit stuff today, we had mentioned last time an idea which one of our listeners has had, and an event which he is wanting to organize. So I wanted to bring him on and have him talk about that a little bit before we get going here. So this is, let me see, where is Jana in our list here? Here is, yes, Jana Redeker, and let me turn his mic on here. Good morning, Jana.
Good afternoon, actually, but good morning for you, Professor.
That's right. And tell everybody, where are you joining us from?
Well, I'm from Holland. I live near Arnhem, actually.
Wonderful. Good afternoon to you.
We have so many connections there. Folks like Jana and Father Roderick and people there. It's interesting.
That's true. My parental home is actually not that far from Father Roderick in Amersfoort, so, well, everything is close together over here.
That's true. Well, Jana, tell us about the idea that you had.
Well, first of all, I want to give credit where credit's due. This was originally not my idea, but it was Trish's. So she came up with it. Yeah, I just wanted to say it.
You mean the illustrious Trish Lambert came up with this idea?
Yeah. Yeah, she did.
Very good.
I have to move my microphone when I laugh so I don't laugh.
This is Trish's new trick, coming up with ideas and foisting them off on other people.
And foisting them on other people. It's called delegation or something like that.
She brought up the idea originally, and I've started to work with it, thinking about it, brainstorming and stuff like that, and I think I have a pretty good idea how I'd like to do it right now, but there are still some things I have to work out. The basic idea is that we have a smaller group, not hundreds of people or something like that, but it's a smaller group like the listening group here, who discuss the movies while we're watching it. And there are two ways I think we could do that. One of them would be to, as has been suggested last episode, to just watch the movie all at once and have an open mic. And the other one is to pause on a regular basis and discuss it for 50 minutes on at key points in the movie. And I don't think one should have to exclude the other.
Right.
But those are the choices we're still facing. I'm still facing. I don't have a cooperator yet, unfortunately. I could really use someone to help me with this, but...
Yes, well, that would be great. So, yes, we definitely a call for volunteers if people would like to help Yana with this idea.
Yeah.
You can get in touch with us through the
Riddles in the Dark. And, Yana, look at the Mythgard site. Yeah, look at Mythgard. Look at the Riddles in the Dark entries, the comments from last episode. Someone did post there that they would love to help you, and they left their email address. So.
And
Ed Powell said he will help out. Yeah, Riddles in the Dark site on Mythgard. And Ed Powell just wrote that he'll help out as well.
Oh, that would be great. And I don't really need much. And the basic thing is I just really want to brainstorm on how we're going to do this because I'm not an expert. I've never done anything like this. And I still really have to get used to listening my own recorded voice, so that would be will be a challenge.
No, that's good. Yeah. We could definitely, I think we can certainly help with hosting this on Mythgard, if that, the Mythgard Netmoot, if that will help. And we can certainly, I agree, I think this is a great idea. I know that a lot of people, as we've been kind of talking our way through this, and, you know, we and everybody else have been paying so much attention to The Hobbit and to the Hobbit films lately that it sort of stimulates the desire to go back and watch the Lord of the Rings films and think about those, you know, to basically apply some of the same kind of thought and analysis to the adaptation process of the Lord of the Rings films. And so I think that that would be a really fun opportunity for everybody to be able to do that together. And maybe, as you say, some of both, you know, being able to talk about it during the film, but then also stopping to be able to kind of, you know, expand a little bit more.
And I, for one, for the longest time, I have wanted to record a riff track style commentary track for this. So
yes.
Yeah, this is a great idea. I'm excited.
Yeah, I was also wondering, I was thinking really of contacting the Middle Earth Network Radio if they could broadcast it when we're doing it so that we have the small discussion group. And because if we get too many, it will just get a mess. And if you understand, if you know what I mean. But if you could have it broadcasted on somewhere else separately, that would work out great because people could still listen and...
Absolutely, yeah. No, I suspect they would be. I suspect they would be very interested in that, and we could. We could definitely see about that. Another option, conceivably, would be to be broadcasting it. Because if we broadcast it on the Mythgard Netmoot, we could have a larger number of a small number of people. Be engaging in the discussion, but a larger number of people could be attending and just listening, and even participating in the sort of by chat, but not having everybody's mic open, because I agree that would get pretty chaotic.
That's exactly what I meant.
So yeah, no, I think one or the other or both actually could work very well. So I'm sure we can get in touch with the Middle Earth Network people and ask them about that.
And yes, Art Lyon just raised his head too, by the way. His hand. So at the end, Yana, I'll give you the contact information for all these folks that have raised their hands and to help you.
That would be good. I think we could meet on Skype or something and discuss it with the organizers. If you know.
Yeah.
And
very good.
I had one with. Oh, yeah. One more thing. You said, we can't do a marathon broadcast because of the movies are very long and we're all in different time zones. So, but I was even thinking that one movie all at once would be a bit long because, well, if you want to have separate discussions outside of the movie itself, then it could run very, very long. So I usually watch the extended edition one DVD at a time because I think it's very long, and I thought that might be a good idea. I know the Fellowship of the Ring splits off very nice with the DVD, and the Two Towers is quite good as well. The Return of the King is in the middle of the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, so that doesn't work out very well, but. I think it's Grunt being moved up to the
Yes, it is. I always find that it's definitely by far the most tantalizing ending. You know, let's bring Grunt up to the gate, and thank you very much. Intermission.
True cliffhanger.
Yep. I recommend including the animated Hobbit and Return of the King in this watching. And maybe also Ralph
Bakshi. Well, and
Bakshi.
Don't forget that in March, the current Hobbit film, the first Hobbit film, is supposed to be coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, too, next month. Sometime,
good
right?
Lord, so, already?
Yeah, that's what I read someplace, yeah.
Yeah, that was exactly my idea, Dave.
Until November.
That was my idea, Dave. If it catches on, we could do it with the Hobbit DVDs. And
sweet, then we could do
it.
That's a great idea.
I've never even watched the animated versions all the way through because I can't get a hand of a copy over here.
Oh, man.
Oh,
yeah. Bummer.
Yeah. Well, the Rankin-Bass Hobbit is definitely worth watching. There are parts of it that I'm not a big fan of, but
Lion is looking forward to singing a group sing-along of Where There's a Whip, There's a Way.
Oh, are you kidding? Yeah, that's like by far the feature right there.
I saw that post. I saw that post on the Tolkien Professor Facebook page, and that was actually the first time I heard that song.
Oh,
you guys have been talking about it so long.
It's a classic. I mean, that is like an iconic song. That song. I mean, man. I have to admit that it's like that song always comes into my head. Like, as I said, I was just reading The Return of the King. So, yeah, I mean, when Frodo and Sam get captured by the orcs in Mordor and the orc guy says, "Where there's a whip, there's a will, my slugs." And I'm just immediately, for the next day, I'm, you know, like going around muttering, "Where there's a whip, there's a way." Fantastic. It's just fantastic. Anyway, so yeah, no, very good.
This could become, and of course, you realize if we go through all of this, we go through the extended editions of The Lord of the Rings, we go through The Hobbit, we go through The Bakshi, we go through the Rankin Bass, then we
material.
Just start all over again. Yeah, well, then we just have to start all over again because, you know, it'll be like a year and then we'll start at the beginning, right? That'll become a tradition.
The annual online.
Great. Well, Yana, as far as I know, we've got two folks that are listening here and then the person who commented on Mythgard's site. So you've got a team of three at this point. And like I said, I'll get with you and I'll make sure you have their contact information so you can take this forward. And, I'm looking forward to it. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Very good.
I thought so.
Very good. Well, thank you, Yana, for sort of kicking this off and really kind of taking charge of this to get it going. It'll be wonderful to see it happen, and I think we will be happy to help to promote this event through Mythgard, and I'm sure the Middle-earth Network people will be interested in it too. So that's very good. We will carry on. So we'll let you conspire with your volunteers here, and maybe we'll do a check-in later on when it's getting a little closer. You guys can explain the format you've decided on and schedule if you've decided on schedules and dates. So we'll have you on again later on to let us know what's happening. But thank you very much. Thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome, Professor.
Get ready to become illustrious,
That's right. That's right. Okay.
Not with my accent.
No, you have a fantastic accent, dude.
Yes, I agree. Okay, well, thank you, Yana. So we are now ready to shift to actual discussion of the text here. So let's first explain kind of the overall parameters of our discussion today. Today we're talking about the spiders, though it's not really just the spiders. Anyway, I do want to talk about the spiders, but it's also that entire episode. Really, we were talking about Mirkwood and the build-up through Mirkwood and how Mirkwood is going to be depicted in the Elven realm in general. That was our focus last time. And this time we want to go not only to the encounter with this. To me, there are sort of three major things that we need to look at. One is the spiders themselves. How are the spiders going to be treated and how are they going to be depicted on film? The second is Bilbo and what's going on with Bilbo, because of course that moment is such an important moment in Bilbo's career. How are they going to handle, what role is the spider incident going to really play
in Bilbo's character arc in film two, and then issue three is the capture by the wood elves. Basically today's discussion, I would like to, if we could, take it all the way up to dwarves locked in prison in the Elven King's realm, and then we can talk more about in the halls of the Elven King and the barrel ride and stuff next time. But those are to me the major issues that we have to look at today, and our riddle itself is going to be focused on the rescue at the end and their capture by the wood elves and the circumstances of that. So that's where sort of eventually what we're going to be building up to. But let's start. Some general discussion about the spiders first, and how you think the spiders might be depicted. Now, one question is, of course we've gotten the spiders already. We saw the spiders attacking Hrosgobel in film one. In some ways kind of raised more questions for me than it answered. And I don't know. I have to say that all things considered, I was kind of disappointed by the spiders in film one, because they seemed... I don't know. The impression I got from the spiders in film one, they seemed sort of large, slow-moving, and dumb. And I didn't understand the rationale of their action at all. It was one of the points of film one that left me just kind of puzzled, actually, trying to figure out what is it that the spiders are up to? Why were they attacking Hrosgobel, and why did they leave? I mean, it's obviously correlated with the sort of exorcism of Sebastian there, but why does that make them go away? And how were they? I was not quite sure. And
that whole
thing
was completely nonsensical.
Yeah, it brought up bigger questions to me. Like, apparently, the spiders are obviously correlated with the rise of darkness in Mirkwood. That's very clear, especially since we saw spider webs in the trees as we got, when Radagast goes to Hrosgobel. So we can see as he reaches the center of the darkness, there's evidence of spiders there. But even just sort of the way they look, they did not seem very intelligent. It's hard for me to imagine the spiders that we saw in film one talking, and imagining a kind of spider society. I mean, they looked like robotic henchmen in film one. And so that's what disappointed me about them. And I'm sort of wondering how they're going to move from that, what exactly that means we're going to get from the spiders when we actually meet them and they are depicted. Shelob, of course, doesn't speak. We never get any dialogue from Shelob. And in the film, more than in the book, because what is done with Shelob in the book is so hard to do on film. I mean, you just can't. I mean, it's all the narrator telling us about, the force of will behind the eyes that they see in the darkness and stuff, like all that stuff, which just like does not translate into a visual medium at all. And so in the film version, what we got from Shelob was basically a big monstrous spider, who looked essentially, I guess what I'm trying to say is she was like an animal. I mean, she was like a beast. It was not obvious from the film, if you didn't know the books, it was not obvious that this was, an ancient and magical creature with intelligence, power, and will of her own. It just looked like, and this is the place where the giant spider lives. Who is dangerous as any large predator would be dangerous. And so are they going to depict the spiders in the same way? The difference in The Hobbit is that we get dialogue from the spiders. And it's not like it's scintillating dialogue. It's not like we see the spiders being highly intellectual or anything like that. But we do get a sense of a spider culture that Bilbo gets a short glimpse into. And are we going to get that? I mean, presumably we're going to get speech. Dave, you had mentioned a while back about, was it you or Trish? Maybe one of you were talking about information that we had about the spider talk and how that's going to actually be done on screen.
Yeah, Dave did. Yeah, I think that was in one of the, like, the Empire.
Yeah,
article,
and I don't 100% remember what it was from. I think you're right though, Trish. I think it was an Empire article, but I do recall that there was a statement from somebody affiliated with the I'm going to try to look it up, but there was a statement from someone affiliated with the production. It might have been Peter Jackson, where they basically intimate that the ring, they hint at this idea that the ring gives the wearer the power to understand the speech, you know, black speech and the speech of creatures of Sauron. And so they were basically sort of intimating that's how they were going to resolve the spider speech thing, that Bilbo would be able to understand them because of the ring. Now, whether that means that the viewers will be able to understand the spiders, I don't know. Like, are we going to actually hear them talking? Maybe are we just going to hear them kind of clicking and creaking as it's described in the book, but maybe we'll get subtitles like when the orcs are speaking, or maybe the spiders will just be speaking their own speech, but Bilbo will sort of give us kind of, you know, thinking out loud translations. I don't know.
Right.
Let's see.
God, yeah, I can't help but think of part. You know, what was the snake tongue in Harry Potter that only Harry could understand?
Parcel tongue, yes.
Parcel tongue, yeah.
But see,
yeah.
Even there, we heard the audience hears the snake, right?
You know,
the
right, audience, that's right.
Not all the time. I mean, there are times when, you know, Nagini is on screen and Voldemort will speak to her, apparently in English, and we will. But there's also didn't we hear whispered snake? Am I misremembering? That we actually hear English translation of Parcel Tongue from snakes on screen. Do we not? Maybe we don't. Maybe I am misremembering. Come to think of it,
you're misremembering.
The less confident I am in my statement.
We don't. I mean, we hear the parcel tongue, and it very clearly is different from just random hissings of a snake. But
right.
But we don't see any like on screen translation either. We can't understand it. We don't get subtitles. Usually, we just get kind of like they make it very clear what's being said through the action on screen, or we get one of the characters maybe sort of translating it.
Right, like when at the beginning of the Half-Blood Prince, when Nagini comes in the hall past the muggle standing out in the hall, and Voldemort says, "Nagini says there is a muggle out in the hall."
Exactly.
Listening to every word you say. Yes. That would be awkward because Bilbo has nobody to talk to, so he would have to be like, "I'm sitting here for no reason telling myself the thing that I am hearing." It's hard to see how that would work with nobody for him to translate to.
Sharon thinks we'll hear clicking before Bilbo puts on the ring, and then we'll hear the speech once the view goes all
ring-mode-y. Here you go. They'll speak in a form of psychic communication, promised Peter Jackson in December's Empire edition, so only Bilbo hears them.
Okay. So
I don't know what that is.
Okay.
That on the one hand,
he'll hear them in his head.
Yeah, on the one hand, that doesn't clear things up at all. On the other hand, that sounds extremely worrisome. Or worrying.
Oh, that's right, Elliot.
Psychic communication. Okay.
Psychic
communication. Elliot does mention, if you remember in Harry Potter in the first movie when he let the snake out at the zoo,
snake said, Elliot, that's what I was thinking.
Oh,
we
yeah, there you
the
go.
Snake? Saying adios, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay, good. I'm so glad that I'm not just crazy, Elliot. I thank you for remembering that, because I was sure we heard a snake's voice at some point in the Harry Potter films. We've just finished watching. We've watched all eight. I've just seen all eight of the Harry Potter films in the last couple months, because we've been watching them with my son. Okay. Whew. All right. I am so glad.
Elliot, it made his day.
Yeah, that absolutely makes my day. Sometimes I just like, because it's been known to happen before, you know, that I remember something very clearly that didn't happen, but I'm glad that it's not occurring now. So, okay, good. So,
But the question, that psychic remark is the thing that it throws into question for me is that so that basically they're not going to have any language. It's not a question of clicks and hisses that will be interpretable, but rather they, I guess, communicate telepathically with each other, and Bilbo is going to be able to, like, it's like he's tuning in his CB to that frequency when he turns on the ring, right? That he's able to hear, like, the spider bandwidth when he's got the ring on. That is, I guess, how it's going to work. That's not, like, utterly illogical. Why these spiders would have the power of telepathy, I'm not quite sure. That's, to me, the most puzzling element of that whole thing. In some ways, it's easier to understand if... that is to say, the idea that for some reason clicks and hisses become comprehensible when he's wearing the ring is, I think, more awkward and difficult. Because, again, how do you handle that in the actual audio track? Do you just turn on the subtitles when he puts on the ring? Do you, like, how do you convey to the audience that he is still hearing the same clicks and hisses, but now it makes sense to him, right? Do you suddenly turn on the subtitles? Do you overlay that sound so that it's still audible, but overlay it with English? Do you have the clicks and whistles shut off and English replace it? So the idea that there is no actual spoken language at all, but it is simply now he can sort of hear them thinking, I guess, makes sense to me from a film utility standpoint. But it makes a little bit less sense to me from a story about the spiders standpoint.
Yeah, I don't know. I'll be interested to see how it goes, and I really hope it doesn't end up looking dumb.
Yeah.
What would you prefer? There's a question, as opposed to speculating just on what they might do or what they've hinted at, because I think we can always take things with a grain of salt. How do you think would be the best way to do this on screen?
It's very challenging because in some ways this scene is one of the most uncharacteristic. In one way, I find it one of the most uncharacteristic moments in Tolkien's fiction. That is, that the spiders speak English.
Mm-hmm.
The wolves didn't speak English. The wolves spoke, the wargs speak wolf language. And it's a wicked and horrible sounding language, but they speak their own language. We've been over the talking animals before, but and when we did, I've said this before, but the spiders are very strange. There's no excuse for the spiders in the book to speak English. And so this problem is created in large part by Tolkien himself and his choice to have Bilbo overhear the spiders, who are apparently, for some reason, speaking English to each other. And I say English and not Westron, because Westron doesn't exist yet in The Hobbit. It's English that they're speaking. And again, so that a raven would speak, would be able to speak English is no shock, because these are ravens who were taught to converse with, the dwarves. So they have learned a second language, as indeed, a very intelligent talking bird could do. The fact that eagles speak English also seems less surprising. But the spiders, why don't the spiders speak spider language? I cannot explain. I don't have an answer for why Tolkien did not have the spiders speak spider language, other than apparently he wants Bilbo to be able to understand it. So he just has them speak comprehensibly. But it really stands out to me in this book, in the Hobbit book, as I won't say an inconsistency, because I don't believe that The Hobbit, at least as it's initially conceived, was designed to be consistent with it's not fair to look at The Hobbit and say it's inconsistent with The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion, because it was never intended to be. And certainly it can't be consistent with The Lord of the Rings fully, because it predated it by a couple decades. But so again, I don't want to demand unfair levels of consistency and continuity, but it's challenging. Now, you notice that I've just been delaying answering the question forever. How I would do it, Dave? Because
you're just
I don't
tap
know.
Tap dancing.
I'm completely tap dancing around it. But basically, again, the problem is caused by the fact that the way that Tolkien depicts it wouldn't work. And not only does it not work on the screen, frankly, it doesn't work in Tolkien's world either. It's inconsistent with Tolkien's world.
Yep.
It's just one of those elements of The Hobbit which still stand out, which is not really smoothed in, and which I bet you I'd be willing to lay almost any sum of money on the proposition that if Tolkien had gotten so far as chapter 8 in his revision that he began of The Hobbit in 1960, when he went back and started rewriting the entire Hobbit in the mode and style of The Lord of the Rings, had he gotten to chapter 8, I am positive that this problem would not have remained there, that he would have given the spider, he would have done something different with that, I'm sure of it. That he would not have turned down, that he would not have turned away from this language problem, of all things. So they can't just be speaking English. That would look dumb. And since they resisted in the film already having the eagles speak English, they're certainly not going to have the spiders speak English.
Well, you know, this is a little ways down the line. Well, two things. First of all, I want to give Harold Johnson credit here, because he brought up a point that I wanted to say. Pertaining specifically to this, which is I do also remember, I think, Dave, from that same article or an article you were citing at the same time, where Jackson talks about that the effects of the ring are going to be sort of cumulative, or they're going to, you know, like the ring is going to create more effects as time goes on and the more Bilbo wears it. And Harold brought up the thing of, you know, this could be another episode of the ring waking up, you know, where he can understand the spider. So it could be an effect of the ring, you know, a broader effect, like Jackson was saying. The other thing is that I was re-listening to Rob Inglis's Hobbit the other day, and he does this great, you know, deal of the raven in the Hobbit, when the raven shows up and talks to the dwarves. And I was thinking about the movie, and I thought, surely the raven in the movie is going to have to talk, because he has such a pivotal, you know, there's so much information that he gives.
Hope so.
He's going to have to talk. So, yeah. So, I mean, then sort of back, you know, how do you back extrapolate? Anyway, you know, bringing that back to this, the spiders talking could be kind of, you know, setting up the fact that this could happen in Middle Earth, so that when we get to the raven, it's not like out of the blue sky that suddenly the raven starts to talk. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean,
the
raven, I think, is in a different category, because, the ravens aren't quite tame birds, but they're close. You know, these are birds that are at least friends with the dwarves, if not actually trained by them. And so that, I think, is comfortable. Even if it's different, it wouldn't see, they're in a different category. You're not just overhearing wild animals talking to each other in their native habitat. You know, these are birds interacting with human beings as they have been trained to interact with human beings, as they have been accustomed, at the very least, if not trained, to interact with human beings. But with the spiders, I think, you know, Dave, what I would be tempted to do is just cut the dialogue. It's not like it's absolutely mandatory. And Trish, what you were just saying about Roach was reminding me of this. Yes, Roach has to talk. The thrush has to be able to communicate. Because that's both of those things are pivotal. There's no information we get from the spiders. You know, the spiders' conversation is primarily comic relief. He doesn't have to overhear spider talk in order to. So Dave, maybe I would, if I were making the film, would just make the spiders silent.
Yeah, that's
or
what
have
I would
them
do too.
Quick and hiss to suggest that they have language, but Bilbo doesn't have to understand them.
Yeah, or you could even have Bilbo mention it a couple times that he does seem to understand them, but you don't have to have him like sitting there listening in to detailed conversations about whether to kill the dwarves now and hang them, or to leave them alive and let them hang a little bit longer and that kind of stuff. I think you're right. Like I'm actually kind of surprised that they're bothering to include, you know, some element of Bilbo listening in on their conversations, and that they're bending over backwards far enough to explain it as to come up with the idea of like psychic communication. Although, you know, maybe the final product is basically going to look like the dialogue's been cut. So
right, maybe, and though I mean certainly, because I agree with you, Dave. It is a little bit surprising that they're going that they're not taking the simplest route as they did with the eagles. Again, like the eagles are silent; they didn't have to be, but it was in the film. It was pretty easy to make the eagles silent, actually. And it would be just as easy, presumably, to make the spiders silent. It wouldn't be any harder anyway to make the spiders silent than it was to make the eagles silent. But they haven't done that, apparently. And if they're not doing that, they have to have a reason. And I think, you know, as you said, you know, Trish, as you were pointing out, as Harold was pointing out, the only active reason is if they want to use this as an illustration of the ring and its power. That, like, basically, this is the time. Because Bilbo has no reason, from film one, there is no reason that Bilbo has to suspect that there's anything malicious about his ring, that there's anything at all. I mean, it's just turned him invisible once. He's only had it on his finger one time. It turned him invisible. He recognized that it turned him invisible, and that's been the entire relationship between Bilbo and the ring so far. If we are going to have this ring getting a hold on him and its powers increasing as time goes on in order to set up for the reader, to transition from the reader from, hey, look, an invisibility ring, to this is the ring of power and prepare yourself because the Lord of the Rings films come after this. Like, if that's the work that's going to be done with Bilbo, that's the only excuse I can see for introducing the idea. Is that Bilbo would presumably be surprised, I guess, that he can understand the spiders? I don't know.
What's the idea of the ring being sort of a black speech universal translator? Because now that I think of it, you know, in his conversation with Smaug, he's also got the ring on. And I wonder if Jackson is setting us up for that.
But I think the dragons are known to speak the common languages, right?
I mean, that's...
Well, I don't know. In Jackson's universe, I have no idea.
Right, oh, okay, exactly. Good point. I mean, that's like fairy tale tradition. Being able to talk to the dragons is normal. Even to the point where you remember those comments in The Hobbit, like, this is, of course, the way that you should talk to dragons. Like, there's like, a customary protocol for, like, how smart people talk to dragons and don't talk to dragons. So, like, the fact that dragons can talk is, you know, an obvious assumed step in that process. But you're right. This doesn't assume that we shouldn't necessarily assume that it's the case in Jackson's world. That just anybody can talk.
Now, Art Lyon brings up the idea. Art Lyon brings up the idea that the spiders talking could be used to enhance the Dol Guldur storyline. For example, they may mention their master or the tower in their conversations. So that might be a reason.
That's an interesting point. I think that's kind of the next thing that we should consider. To what degree will the spiders be coordinating with what's going on with Dol Guldur and incorporated in that storyline? In other words, in the book, the it's just kind of bad luck that the dwarves stumble upon them and that the spiders' main interest in the dwarves is eating them. In the first film, there's already very strong hints that the spiders are being manipulated or controlled by Dol Guldur. You know, that they've been sent on this perplexing, completely odd mission to attack and then subsequently retreat from Ross Goble. But there seems to be a strong hint that the spiders weren't just doing that at random or because they thought that there was a tasty treat in there, that they were doing that because of some connection to the necromancer. So,
yeah, Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, at the very least, they're presented in film one as symptomatic of the rise of the necromancer. Now, the thing in Tolkien's works, the spiders, and there are bunches of spiders. I mean, there's Ungoliant in the Silmarillion and the Children of Ungoliant, that is like Shelob's brothers and sisters, who are living in Ered Gorgoroth, you know, in the mountains of terror between Gondolin and Doriath, that Beren travels through. And then you've got Shelob, of course, and then you've got the Mirkwood spiders. And all of these spiders in Tolkien all seem to be more or less free agents. You know, we don't get, like, legions of spider armies being led into war or sent into war by Morgoth or Sauron. Now, all of them, Morgoth and Sauron, you know, all of the spiders are sort of exploited by Morgoth and Sauron. I mean, they are all evil creatures, and as evil creatures who like to prey upon and destroy good people and beautiful things, they are useful as tools to Morgoth and Sauron from Ungoliant on down. But they don't. But they're never like under the command of them, and this seems to be the case. That certainly seems to be the case in The Hobbit. I mean, of course, in the published Hobbit, we don't get any sense of the spiders being coordinated with Dol Guldur, though even there is, you know, that idea seems to be a very early one for Tolkien. That is, the presence of the spiders is clearly one of the plain indications of the darkening of the forest and the spread of evil through the forest in the books as well, and which is, of course, correlated with the rise of Dol Guldur. So, you know, the correlation between the two is present, but not chain of command. And it will be interesting to see if they introduced that. And I could imagine that. I could imagine them overhearing something about Dol Guldur or the spiders referring to the necromancer, or even the idea that the spiders might be capturing them for, you know, intending to carry them to Dol Guldur or something. That they're being rescued from. I wouldn't expect that, and I would kind of hope that that wouldn't happen, but I could imagine that.
Yeah, me too. I just had a horrible thought. I hope to God that we don't have anybody riding spiders into the Battle of Five Armies.
Yeah. God. Really, let's hope the spiders stay out of the Battle of Five Armies entirely.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
I would expect them to be at the Battle of Dol Guldur, and if not,
right,
the primary combatants in the Battle of Dol Guldur.
Yeah.
But let's do hope they don't accompany the goblins.
Yeah. We may have to return to this after we see the second movie and see how they deal with the spiders.
I'm optimistic they won't do that. There'll be so many creatures there that seems like that would be it. Well, then again,
we'll have
so
to
many
battle
creatures.
15 armies.
Right. Yeah, right.
Exactly.
The battle. Yeah, that's a good point. The battle of everything we can throw in.
That's right.
the battle of the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
So I think another interesting question besides to me, I think that the two really big questions about the whole spider scene are, one, to what degree will they be connected to the necromancer, and will that be used to develop that storyline? And to what degree is the necromancer storyline going to overlap with the main storyline? Like, is he actually going to try and pursue the party? And if he does, why? What are his purposes? He can't possibly... You know, it's very tempting to start imagining some kind of connection with the ring. I mean, they're taking it so close to where Sauron is, but at the same time, that really introduces a can of worms in terms of later storyline. Like, if he knows it's there, how did he lose track of it? So that seems unlikely. So there's that connection. The other thing I think that's really interesting is how is this a huge character moment for Bilbo, and how's it going to change? Because I really think that they're going to have to change it, because I think Bilbo's already had the kind of character development that he undergoes at this point. I think he's already done it.
Right. Right, exactly. Excuse me. This is one of the things that we talked about when we were discussing the film after its release, and especially the moment that you know, sort of the final scene, or rather the culminating action scene of the film, and people's objecting to, you know, Bilbo charging in and fighting the goblins to rescue Thorin at the end. And, you know, one of the arguments that I was making and that, you know, that we were discussing at the time was that seems to be basically just moving forward this particular step that Bilbo takes. So I agree. The question is what room is there left in Bilbo's for Bilbo's character, as he's already had that kind of development. Now, on the one hand, it's a bigger step. It still is a step forward in that it's one thing to charge in and save Thorin's life, you know, when a goblin is standing over him about to kill him. And it's another thing to say, like, I'm going to set out by myself and single-handedly invade a spider colony and rescue the dwarves by myself in this forest that I can't even find my way around in. I mean, that's a big deal. It's a bigger deal. It will take more resolution from him. But yeah, as far as like his on-screen character arc, one could see it as kind of the next step. Well, okay, here's my theory about it. The way that it could change, let me back up one step further. The change I suspect is coming, where I think his character arc is going to be in film two. In film one, he goes from, I don't want to be here in the first place and you all think I'm useless anyway, to he is accepted as a part of the company and he has found his own courage and you know, realizes that, you know, he makes that, you know, the realization, the speech that he makes about how he wants to help them get their home back, and that he is willing to sacrifice his own comfort for that, and that he would not turn back now. In the second one, I think the dynamic, and this again is from the book, is the process by which Bilbo not only becomes a more intrepid adventurer, but becomes, as the narrator says, the real leader of their expedition. That he not only becomes competent, but really takes on a leadership role and is the one who continually gets them out of trouble and whom the dwarves begin to look to get them out of trouble whenever he's in trouble, that they actually look to him for leadership. That hasn't happened. Hasn't happened at all by the end of film one. And that is what I would expect to see from Bilbo's character arc, and it makes to me the more sense in that it sets up the rivalry between him and Thorin, which culminates in the Descendant of Rats, you know, and Bilbo being almost thrown off the wall.
Right. So his evolution goes from being kind of a someone that the dwarves brought along reluctantly, and he's basically baggage. Yes. To second film is where he assumes, like, they finally are happy because he's pulling his own weight and actually making real contributions. He's saved Thorin's life now. And they start turning to him more and more for leadership. Movie three, conflict is introduced because what we discover is not only can he exhibit leadership, but in fact, he has his own agenda as well. And it's
right, which is not the same as and that he and Thorin start leading them or wanting to lead them in very different directions.
Right.
Again, this is what we have. We see Bilbo in, you know, once they get to the Lonely Mountain, begin to actively disapprove of Thorin and what Thorin is doing, which culminates, of course, in his giving away of the Arkenstone, and which may well culminate in that same thing in the film. So yeah, exactly. So I would expect then, if that is the trajectory that happens, that film two would be establishing that leadership role, and setting up the conflict, you know, the beginning of tension between him and Thorin.
Brings in the question of whether or not Thorin will be present. You know, is it going to be like in the book where he gets captured first, or will he be actually there when the spiders wrap everybody up?
Right. You know what? I think it would be All right, here's what I predict. Though keep in mind, when I say I predict this, I'm predicting this in my old mode of, here's how I would do it if I were making the film, and we all know how accurate those predictions are. But my prediction based on that is that Thorin would be captured first, because the first step, if Bilbo's first step towards leadership is basically Thorin is helpless and Bilbo has to step in, then that really minimizes Thorin, and it's hard to see them minimizing Thorin after what they did with Thorin in film one. However, if he's absent, it's a very logical step and a very non-threatening step for Bilbo to step in and be like, while Thorin isn't here, somebody's got to do something, and I guess, by golly, it's got to be me, apparently. And then, you know,
yeah,
he is reunited with Thorin.
Everybody else is wrapped up in spider webs. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And then he's reunited with Thorin, and you know, and they're all fine, but maybe the beginning of a little bit of tension. But again, there's still not a, like, let's push Thorin aside. Thorin is helpless. He's not the leader anymore. Bilbo displaces him immediately. I think that tension I would expect to begin at Lake Town. When they come back and Thorin is you know, being reestablished in his claim and is beginning to get a swollen head about the, you know, the as the dwarves do in Lake Town, you know, going around and acting as if Smaug were already chopped up into little pieces. And Bilbo's like, and he's skeptical and he's resistant and he is trying to basically oppose the optimism or enthusiasm or whatever. Not that that's going to necessarily happen in exactly that same way as it does in the book, but again, it would all make sense if that happened. So I would expect the separation with Thorin. I would expect Thorin not to be among the dwarves who are captured by the spiders and rescued by Bilbo, because I think that that's too strong a move at the beginning to have Thorin be helpless and have him have to rely on Bilbo immediately.
Yeah, and this and especially the Thorin that we've seen on screen in the film, it's hard to imagine him ever being in a being completely helpless, except maybe in the Elven King's dungeon when he's imprisoned
right.
and can't get out.
Right.
But and these dwarves in general, like, you know, maybe when they're wrapped up in spider casings and poisoned, they won't do much. But it seems as soon as they are able, they will fight back. I mean, they've mm-hmm. never we've seen them multiple times now go just diving into battle.
Yes.
In the historical flashbacks, but also against the trolls and against Azog and his cronies, and also in Goblin Town. I mean, they're very capable. So it should be very interesting to see how the scene goes.
Yep. Yep. Yep, I agree. So
do you think we'll see Bilbo taunting the spiders?
Yes. I certainly hope. This sounds like a conundrum question. Will we hear the word Attercop uttered by anyone in the films? And I would predict yes. I would say yes to the Attercop question. Because they kept so much of the sort of classic beloved and comical moments from the book in film one, even when they had to go out of their way to do it, that I would expect that Bilbo will, I possibly both Attercop and Tom Noddy, but at least Attercop, I would expect. I do think that we're going to get that. The only question, and this begins to lead up to the riddle, is his deliverance of the dwarves from their captivity by the spiders going to be single-handed as it is in the book?
Right.
And you know,
well,
the
you know,
more.
And I thought about that. You mean as far as the elves are concerned?
Yes, as far as the elves are concerned.
He's going to have to not be known. The elves can't know that he's around, I realized after I had come up with my draft question.
Oh, crap, yeah.
Right? Because, keeping up there? so I mean, he has to basically be quote-unquote invisible to the elves. I mean,
right.
In order for him
But, to you know, that actually could happen very easily. That could happen very easily. Bilbo
sees the spiders around the dwarves, and he's like, okay, step one, I've got to lead them away, and then I've got to sneak back and rescue the dwarves. So he lures them away, Adderkop, Tom Noddy, and he has the ring on, and he doubles back, returning to where the dwarves were, only to find them being cut down and hauled away by the elves.
So remind me chronologically, when he leads the spiders away, has he already freed some of the dwarves?
No, the very first thing he does is lead them away, and then he comes back and frees a couple of the dwarves. And then the spiders start to return, and they fight off the spiders while the rescued dwarves free the other dwarves. And then he leads them on a fighting retreat, and when it looks like that's going to fail, then he puts the ring on again. This is when he reveals the presence of the ring, yes. The existence of the ring, rather, to the dwarves. And he... and then he goes off and doesn't exactly weed them away, but he ambushes them from the side and does try to distract them and lead some of them off to give the dwarves a better chance of succeeding in their fighting retreat from the spider. So that's how it happens in the book. The intervention of the elves, when we first, Dave, I remember when you and I first heard about this, like a year ago, and we were both filled with chagrin and trepidation when we heard about Legolas and Toriel rescuing the dwarves from the spiders. I have to admit, I feel differently about it after watching film one, mostly because of that shift that we were talking about how they shifted Bilbo's heroic, his first heroic moment. Earlier on, we've had that now. My chief concern about it, which I think I said at the time, was that if you have Legolas come in and rescue them from the spiders, you have taken away this crucially important moment in Bilbo's character. You just water that down and take all of the impact away from that moment for Bilbo. But he's had that moment now. So that actually doesn't seem to me as if he still does the most important thing. The most important thing that seems to me that's sort of remaining to be done for Bilbo is for him to take that step of going to seek them and taking on the spiders. I don't think that if the whole sequence is not completed as in the book, I don't think that's as big a deal anymore. I mean, I still want to see Bilbo single-handedly going, tracking them to the spiders. So he's setting out to rescue his friends single-handedly. He takes them on and lures them away and draws them to attack himself. If he has the courage to do all those things, he still will have accomplished everything that it seems like he still needs to accomplish.
Right, yeah. It seems like, I think... part of what makes this critical in the book is sort of that first moment when he kills the first spider that's trying to sew him up, and he has that thought that, like, killing that spider, like, really kind of awakens something in him and fills him with confidence, because it's like, he did it, and there's no Gandalf, and there's no dwarves, and he did it by himself, and he's in the dark, and he's like, I can do this. And that doesn't seem as critical now.
Yep. I agree. It's not quite as critical, though it does raise the question, which I'm glad you raised, about that particular turning point, not the rescue, but his turning point with the spider beforehand. Are we going to get the naming of the sword? Are we going to get that moment?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of Bilbo stinging fly moment.
That seems necessary, right? Like, he has to name the sword. I was thinking about that last night, and I was thinking, like, that seems, of all the elements from this scene, if you listed them and just started asking which ones are a necessity, could they not do without?
Yes.
The naming of the sword
yes.
seems like one of those to me.
I agree, especially since we've had a setup for it with, like, the conversation about, the letter opener conversation with Balin, right, in Rivendell. And the way that the giving of the sword to Bilbo by Gandalf front in the Troll's Cave, the emphasis that's placed on that. We've had several, like, Bilbo holding his sword and looking at it moments in film one. And so, yeah, I agree. Those seem to be, like, if they're not setting it up for him giving the sword a name,
then, you know, what is the point of that? But you know, I still think that there is a step for them to, even though they have had him, you know, drawing his sword and acting purposefully heroic at the end of the first film, that sense of, you know, the Bilbo at the end of the first film still hasn't named his sword, you know, and that is, it's still not, his own sense of his own identity hasn't really changed, and that's the important thing about that moment in the book, is of course it's his sword that he's naming, but it's himself that he's giving an identity there, and it's his own understanding of himself that is really being changed, and that I think is what's being articulated in his song to the spiders when he you know, calls himself, you know, a naughty little fly, and is clearly thinking in those terms, like when with the dwarves later on, in my favorite line in the scene when he says, you know, go on, I will do the stinging. He is still in alluding to the name of his sword, which the dwarves don't know, of course. He is still working out his own idea. He's still articulating his own identity of the stinging fly that he has now given to himself. But that transition still hasn't happened. Even at the end of the film, you know, in the speech that he has with Thorin on top of the Carrick at the end of film one, I don't get the clear sense that Bilbo now looks at himself fundamentally differently. You know, that his own concept of his identity has really changed. His concept of his purpose has changed, right? You know, that he is now determined to, he is now determined to help them. He is setting out, you know, he is now, a partner with them in their quest. He has fully embraced it, rather than just being an unwilling tag-along, or at least a reluctant tag-along, someone who is out of place and who has been happy to be out of place, even cheerfully out of place. But
he's not yet the guy that's like, that's going to sit there and say, you know what, you guys go on, I got this.
Right. Exactly. You know, that sense of like, I am a warrior, like I can do this. Like I am the stinging fly. These spiders are and will be afraid of me. You know, that's a thing that happens to Bilbo in this moment in the book. That's, again, that to me, that's what the stinging fly image conveys. And that's the significance of the naming of the sword.
Well, I could definitely see that happening. I think one of the things that I'm influenced by is, you know, we have that still photo of Bilbo kind of staring at his sword.
Yes.
Obviously in the spiderweb area. And that's kind of what that still conveys to me, is that he has this kind of epiphany moment. Even though he's done what he's done in the past, this is kind of like it's all on his shoulders, and, you know, right. That I could see that. And we're assuming, I think Sarah asked this question, that the naming of Sting is going to happen basically around that moment, right? So it'll happen in that, you know, during the spider deal.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, it's hard for me to see them taking it away, especially since the name Sting.
Yeah, it would lose context. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a you know, a generally insect oriented. I know spiders,
yes,
aren't insects,
right.
but anyway, it's, you know, so yeah, no, I think it.
But a stinging fly is, so that's
right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So no, I would expect that. I mean, I wouldn't think that they would change that. And I do agree with Dave that it's very difficult for me to imagine them not having the name, because it's how we're introduced. You know, in Fellowship of the Ring, when Bilbo takes the sword out and gives it to Frodo, it's like, this is Sting, right? I mean, so its
right.
name is foregrounded, and not just by the merchandising department. Yeah.
Of course, you know,
yeah.
We have another question then is, you know, in the third film, will a big deal be made out of when he goes back to Rivendell, you know, getting it etched?
Right. Yeah. Actually, Bilbo's return to Rivendell will be an interesting thing, but it's a film three question. I'm not going to get drawn.
Actually, one thing I want to go on record for, although I think we want to discuss it in the next episode when we're talking about being in the Elven King's Hall, I just want to look and see who brought it up, because I think it's Art brought it up, but I had the same thought, that we were talking about, you know, Thorin and Bilbo's tension, and that the humiliation I'm expecting, given the way Thorin's depicted in the movie, that the humiliation of having to be, you know, rescued by Bilbo from the Elven King's Hall is going to really grate on Thorin. So I just want to stick that stick in the sand there, but I think that's really for next episode to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, no, because it is a barrel episode, a barrel riding issue. But yeah, no, I think that will be interesting. And if it has to happen twice, you know, if Thorin is a helpless captive of the spiders and then a helpless captive of the elves, I don't see that happening. Oh my goodness! I mean, he's grumpy enough already for crying out loud. I mean, let's not totally emasculate the poor guy.
So, maybe it's worth revisiting the Thorin thing, which we posed as a question a lot, like way back in season one of Riddles in the Dark. Do we think Thorin will be at the spider battle, or will he be captured earlier?
I think it's going to be earlier. And that
really?
Leads to. I
Weren't
do.
You the one that
I
originally do. Thought yeah. he'd be at the spider battle?
Yeah, I
did too, but
one.
I think I've changed my mind as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the main thing that changes my mind, you're right, Dave, and my original rationale was, they're going to want to establish, you know, Thorin's heroism, and, you know, and to lose the opportunity of having Thorin there fighting spiders is going to be too hard. But that was before the whole Thranduil thing they did in film one. Now I think the primary focus is going to be the spiders are a sideline, and it's okay for Thorin to miss the sideline. First of all, his like studliness in battle has been amply established. It's you know, his stock isn't going to go down at all if he's not there with the spiders, but the more important thing is that, you know, clearly the major issue, which I would expect to be one of the dominant issues in film two, is going to be the Thorin Thranduil plot, which was so plainly set up in film one, and that is what I expect to take center stage. So this brings us to the next step, which is the encounters with the elves. What about the elven feast stumbling and them staggering into the circles and having the elves disappear? Wait a second.
We got to go back to spiders for a second, because Sharon Hoff points out that technically flies do not sting. They bite or suck, so Bilbo could have named his sword Sucker.
Sucker. Right. No. No, that just doesn't work.
And of course, we already have a biter.
Yes, we already have a biter.
That's right. So we can
have a biter. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway, no, sorry for that small comedy moment, but back to Elfring.
Right. So the Elfrings. Okay. So, by which I mean not the rings of power, but the circles that elves, the places where elves go. So, Dave, what do you think? Do you think we're going to get any version of the Elven King at feast in the forest and the dwarves coming in and disturbing their feasting by night concept?
I was listening to this chapter last night while on a run, and I was thinking about that very question. I was also thinking about the thing that we touched on last episode with Bomber falling in the water and whether the source of and that sort of the mixture of dangers that are present in the forest. There's kind of the corruption and darkness. There's the evil danger, and then there's the sort of perilous danger of fairy. Because they were talking about the narrator describes how they hear voices singing, and they're merry voices, and they're laughing, and the singing is beautiful, but it doesn't make them feel any better. It doesn't comfort them because it sounds sort of eerie and mysterious . And I was thinking about that, and then also about the dinners, then feasting. I don't know, man. It's such a weird kind of little thing that happens. Like, they keep stumbling into these parties, and the lights go out, and the elves just run away.
I certainly would not expect it to be done like it's done in the book.
No.
Because in the book, it's being played mostly for like the fairy tale motif. I mean, this is if you come across, you may indeed be out in the woods one night. Like, I mean, this is a medieval tradition. You may indeed be out in the woods and hear the sound of laughter and feasting and come across elves dancing, you know, elven maidens dancing or elves feasting. And if you do, what will almost certainly commonly happen is that they will disappear as soon as the mortal stumbles in. There's a long tradition of that. And, of course, you run a very serious risk of being abducted yourself in punishment for having disturbed them. And that, of course, is what happens. That's what happens to Thorin. He is taken by the elves when he disrupts them for the third time. So that's how it's played up in the book, and I certainly agree. We're not going to get that kind of fairy tale tradition because we're not there anymore. Not only are we not there anymore in the films, we weren't there anymore by the time Tolkien is writing The Lord of the Rings. So, you know, the ways in which the original Hobbit book was very interested in developing and employing these kinds of traditional fairy tale motifs is not gone, but transformed, very different. Once we're in the Lord of the Rings world. Now, now thinking about those moments from the point of view of the film world that we're given, and again, in particular, the Thorin Thranduil issues, imagine now the parallel situation to the book circumstance in the film. The dwarves are starving in the woods and they hear even if Bomber doesn't wake up and do his "I had a dream about the Elven King" thing, which I'd be a little bit surprised if that happened, but even assuming that doesn't happen, you've got starving dwarves, nearly starved to death, wandering in the woods, and they see the elves at feast. Thorin's going to recognize him, right? Thorin's going to recognize Thranduil. Now what happens? What does movie Thorin do? As he's sitting there starving in the woods and he's seeing this guy whom he considers his enemy and indeed the traitor of his kingdom sitting there happily feasting in the woods.
He's going to go after him like he did Azog.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and you know, because you think about the accusation that that the Elven King makes against Thorin in the book is, and I'm correcting myself because of course he's not called Thranduil in the book. The accusation that the Elven King makes against Thorin in the book is that, you know, you did thrice trouble my people. You know, he's accusing them of attacking them, and Thorin is like, "We weren't attacking. We were just coming to beg for food because we were starving. You know, you have completely misinterpreted us. You have completely misunderstood." Well, I'm not sure in the movie it would be a misunderstanding. It's hard to imagine. I mean, but easy to imagine that kind of situation coming up. Sooner or later, we're going to get a Thorin meets Thranduil. I mean, he's going to know he's going through his kingdom when he sets out. I mean, it's got to be an issue from the beginning when they enter Mirkwood, even before they enter Mirkwood. To have somebody, Balin or Bilbo or Gandalf or somebody, talking to Thorin about, like, you're going to go right through Thranduil's kingdom there on your way back. Do you have a plan? What are you going to do? And, you know, I don't know what. You know, Thorin being like, "Well, that jerk better hope I don't run into him." And then, you know, he runs into him in the woods. And what happened? You know, it's like, does he could just throw down right there? Does he charge in and say, like, "You jerk and traitor, how dare you?" And then, you know, or, you know, who knows? But anyway, I think that's going to happen. I think that we're going to get a conflict between Thorin and Thranduil, that Thorin is going to be captured and imprisoned by Thranduil, quite knowingly, you know, knowing full well who he is, and Thorin knowing full well who Thranduil is and what this means. But so there's going to be a serious misunderstanding that will lead to Thorin's imprisonment, and I do think that that's going to happen separately, and then the Bilbo and the other dwarves with the spiders thing will happen separately. Like that now, with the way that they set up the personal grudge between Thorin, or from Thorin to Thranduil, in the first film, leads me to believe that that's going to be one focus while Bilbo is doing his, "Meanwhile, I am like becoming a leader and rescuing everybody" thing, with first the spiders and then the perils.
Well, and I can actually see that is how Thorin gets captured. I mean, I could see the fairy ring being the thing. You know, it doesn't have to happen three times. It could just happen one time where they see this feast going on. Thorin goes, "Thranduil!" Oh, and he runs into the glade. Immediately, the lights go out. Everything disappears before anybody else can get into the glade. Not only are the elves gone, but Thorin's gone as well. I mean, that could happen. Or something maybe a little bit less magical than that. But
Yep.
I could totally under, especially given, like you said, the way they set it up in movie one and how hot-headed Thorin is. Yeah, I could see that's how he ends up getting captured. And nobody else, you know, it happens so fast, nobody else can come to his rescue.
Yeah, I think it's just they have to be careful the way they do it, because if it's like if they run in and it's obvious it's elves and then the elves grab Thorin and run off, I feel like the other dwarves would be like after them. So it doesn't.
Right.
It kind of, in some sense, it needs to maintain a little bit the sort of fairy-esque element where they're there and the lights go out and then basically where they're just completely deceived and befuddled. So you know, lights go out, nobody knows what's going on, and it's not until they like find each other, like, oh, okay, here's everybody. Wait, where's Thorin? And they just have no hope of finding him, and they're wandering around aimlessly.
Right.
Now, I wanted to bring this in at some point. It's broken record time,
which is
the thing that all of us have talked about from the very beginning is pacing. You know, I mean, we've still got to get to Lake Town, and Bilbo's still got to have his conversation with Smaug, I assume.
Oh, yes.
Oh my God! I mean,
keep trying to forget about that. I found like halfway through today's episode, I found that I was confidently and comfortably imagining that Lake Town was going to be the end of this movie. When we're talking about the character arcs, I was totally imagining film two Bilbo's character arc ending at Lake Town. Because my mind just keeps shuddering back from the idea that we're going to get all the way through the conversation.
Well, you know, I could see that, except that we've seen that photo of Bilbo climbing up a mountain of gold.
Yeah.
So.
No, I agree.
No, don't try to make him feel better.
Yeah, no, don't try to make me feel better. It's got. I have to just confront this fact and try to deal with it. So, anyway, okay. But so no, I agree. It's going to be shortened. But I think Dave, I do think it could be done, especially if Thorin goes off on his own.
Mm-hmm.
To confront Thranduil, or maybe that's what happens. Maybe we don't have the we stumble across them in the woods thing. You know, maybe Thorin goes and like, I will go talk to them, or you know,
or it could be the hunting party. You know,
yep.
I mean, Thranduil could show up on his stag, on his moose,
right?
At a hunting party, and Thorin goes running after them.
Shoots the moose. Excuse me, elk.
Shoots the moose.
I am really hoping for that. I'm really
for
hoping
the shooting of the elk
that they keep the shooting of an animal element, and it turns out to be Thranduil's
elk. I would actually kind of love that too. Not that I wish any particular ill to Thranduil's elk, but yes, no, that appeals to me as well, definitely. Well, okay. One way or the other. So again, I'm not sure exactly like how it would be, but I would expect Thranduil and Thorin to confront each other and Thorin to be captured. But you're right, Dave, it has to be done in such a way they can't be like all of the dwarves plus Thorin encounter confront the elves, and the elves just somehow take Thorin and leave everybody else and nobody knows what happened. That kind of the way that the elves magically vanish, I do expect not to happen on screen. That's just not how the elves in the movies operate. So it's not going to be able to be exactly like that, Thorin. But I do suspect that they would be able to find a way to separate Thorin from the rest of them for his confrontation with Thranduil, and for him to be taken while the dwarves and Bilbo are either waiting or doing something else and then being waylaid by the spiders while they're either waiting for Thorin or even pursuing Thorin or whatever.
Right.
This leads us to, actually, the riddle, which is...
Oh, I have one other thing I wanted to... This could be for next week, too. Well, you and I talked about it briefly before the show today. And again, it could be for next episode, but I just, again, want to kind of sow the seed, is the Legolas-Thranduil relationship. Because I assume, from what we know so far, Legolas is actually going to be showing up during the spider fight. And, you know, as Corey and I talked about prior to the show, and Dave would not have approved because he would have been saying, save it for the show, is...
why didn't you save
Legolas,
it for the show?
That Legolas, at this point, we're assuming, is not a dwarf lover.
Yes.
I mean, at least according to, you know, what we assume in the book and what we see in Fellowship of the Ring is, you know, it's not like, Corey, you said, not until Lothlorien, really, that he and Gimli kind of have their, you know, their bromance doesn't start until then.
Exactly.
So, you know, are we going to see Legolas being, because a lot of the, as Dave, as I was saying to Corey before, a lot of the fan art, you know, some of the funny things that have shown up on Facebook have been, you know, like Thranduil and Legolas having kind of the father-son, you know, conflict, and that Legolas is pro-dwarf and Thranduil's not. Well, I will be very disappointed if that's the case, frankly.
Not initially, anyway.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, I would imagine there would be, like, you know, some kind of seeds sown, some kind of movement on Legolas's part. Because remember, I mean, even in the film, they very prominently had Legolas and Gimli fighting against, you know, not just fighting against each other personally, but both of them deeply bigoted against the other race at the Council of Elrond. Again, I'm talking about in the movie here. So yeah, no, I would think that Legolas. I don't see any reason for us to expect Legolas in the film, especially initially, to be particularly pro-dwarf. But anyways, okay, yes. Working up towards the riddle, because I should probably go before too long here.
One other thing I just want to say real quick.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Brianna's messed us up. Brianna, you've messed us up because she has given us a citation. I'm looking at it right now. Of a scene where Thorin is leading web-covered dwarves in the woods. And I'm looking it up at the moment. So anyway, I just wanted to let you guys know that.
Okay. Okay. Well, as I said, there's a pretty firmly established track record for whenever I do my, well, here's how I would do the film predictions. So, you know, we can take that kind of prediction as qua prediction for exactly what it's traditionally worth. Anyway, I still think, like, as like thinking through the story, you know, I think that the issues that we have raised whenever we do that are still turn out to be very relevant to the film. But yeah, I think we've long since established that the way that I would tell the story if I were doing it and the way that Peter Jackson tells the story are not the same most of the time. Okay, the riddle is the elves coming in. So it's the elves are going to capture the elves' capture of the rest of the dwarves. When and how does that happen, and how does that connect to the spiders? Now, I will say from the outset that our riddle presupposes the fact that there is going to be some elf-on-spider action here in this rescue. You know, that we're not going to get, as in the book, the spiders are completely gone. The 12 dwarves and Bilbo are, you know, at rest in one of the abandoned elf circles, and they are not in danger. And then they set out, and while they're wandering, the elves capture them. So that, like, the capture of the dwarves by the elves is a complete non-action sequence. That is, I'm assuming, not what's going to happen. Because we have some clear evidence that there is going to be an attack on the spiders by the elves, that it will be a fighting rescue of the dwarves from the spiders. But the question is, when and how does that happen? The question is that, so our riddle question is, how do we end up wording it, Trish? You've got it there. What is our question?
Under what circumstances will the dwarves be captured by the wood elves?
Okay. Under what circumstances will the dwarves be captured by the wood elves? Okay. And like last time, we have basically two questions which you have to answer, and the combination of your answers gives you your A, B, C, or D. Okay. Question number one is, when do the elves come in? Do the elves assist the dwarves while the dwarves are still captured by the spiders? That is, while the dwarves are still wrapped up in spider thread, in the webs of the spiders, in the tree, do the elves come then to and rescue them and cut them down and take them away? Or do the elves come in after they've already been cut down by Bilbo and each other, and they are trying to escape? They're doing their fighting retreat from the spiders, and the elves come in then. So those are that's the first question, as you decide when you think the elves come in. The second question is, what do you think are the intentions of the elves
when they come in. That is the group of elves, which captures, which sort of both rescues and captures the dwarves. Is this group of elves sent out from Thranduil with the purpose of waylaying and imprisoning the dwarves? Have they been sent out to corral the dwarves and bring them back? Is that their mission? Or do they meet the dwarves under other circumstances? Either benevolently, like, we were wandering by and we heard someone in distress, so we came to rescue you. Or, like, we just happened by and didn't know what was happening, so we started killing spiders. Or, or even an active mission of benevolence, like, go rescue the dwarves. They are wandering and probably captured by spiders. Go save them. But, so again, either they are sent out with the purpose of capturing the dwarves or not. And so your combination, so A, option A, is they are, the elves capture them after they're released from the spider webs, and they are sent out with the intention of capturing them. And that is, I think, the closest we're going to get to the book answer here. Because this is my own interpretation, but it does to me seem that the party of elves that captures the dwarves was sent out for that purpose in the book. That this is not just a coincidence that they happen across these elves that capture them. Remember, they've already captured Thorin and interrogated Thorin, and after that, they go out and round up the rest of the dwarves. They don't find them till after they've already escaped, quite a bit after they've escaped from the spider webs. But I do believe that that party of elves was detached in order to bring the rest of the dwarves back. So that's option A. Option B is after they capture them after they've been released, but they are not setting out to capture them. Their presence there is either accidental or actively benevolent. Option C is they cut them loose from the spider.
B is they're still sent out to capture the dwarves, but they have to rescue them from the spider.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm doing the binary the other way. Okay, so A and B are both. They're set out to capture the dwarves. And right. A is after they're released, and B is they arrive before they're released. C and D are they don't set out to capture them. They encounter them either benevolently or accidentally. And they rescue them either after they're released or before they're released from the spider threads. So those are our four options. What do you guys think?
Interesting.
I need to hear your analysis before I decide on which particularly unlikely and improbable choice I'm going to select this week.
So, this is an interesting question. I think the elves will come in, if they come in at all, it will be toward the end of the spider confrontation. So I think that Bilbo will be the one that initially frees the dwarves from their casing. I think that will go along the way it is in the book, that they will, that Bilbo will free himself. Bilbo will lead the spiders away and give the dwarves time to free themselves. Bilbo will come back. The dwarves will be besieged by the spiders, and that either they will fight off the spiders at that point and then go wander right into an elven trap, or that the dwarves will be fighting the spiders and maybe be about to be overcome, and then there'll be elven arrows coming out of nowhere, out of the dark and hitting all the spiders, and that they'll kind of help drive the spiders away at the end and then capture them. I don't think they'll come in any earlier than that. That's kind of my thinking. And as to what their purpose there is, that's a good question. I don't know.
Let me lay out one scenario here, because I realize that the option C and the C and D route, that is the idea of the elves not setting out to capture the dwarves, might seem a little bit counterintuitive. But I actually think that we have a very clear model for this. Remember when the Fellowship of the Ring is brought into Lothlorien by Haldir and company?
Mm-hmm.
In the book, and much more so in the film, that almost goes bad. right? I mean, that's a benevolent encounter. Haldir and his people have no particular animosity against them, and certainly haven't been set out to waylay them or anything like that. But in the movie especially, it almost goes bad. You'll recall in the extended edition, like, Aragorn and Legolas have to talk quickly in order to convince them not to be rash. So basically, one could imagine that replace Legolas, or replace, first of all, Legolas switches sides, replace Aragorn the negotiator with a really cranky, cantankerous, and rude Thorin with a grudge, and what you have is a, hi, we see you're lost in the woods. Would you please accompany us back, but we might have to blindfold you or something, and Thorin being like, forget that, and being, you know, all like abusive, and it turns out into an imprisonment instead of an invitation. That's a sequence that I could even imagine them doing, even with actual references back, sort of film references back to that parallel with their being brought into Lothlorien. So I can imagine that, or basically. The elves even coming in and expecting gratitude from the dwarves, like, hey, like, we saw you were being like attacked by spiders, so we saved you. Aren't you thankful? And Thorin being like, I spit upon you, and you're like a day late and a dollar short, my friend. Let's not hear about wood elves riding into the rescue at the apropos moment, Mr. I did nothing when the dragon attacked Erebor. And then, again, things deteriorate, possibly with combat, and the dwarves are captured. So I can see that kind of scenario unfolding. So I don't. I definitely think in that way that the accidental or benevolent meeting with the dwarves does seem to be a viable option for that.
Oh, that's an interesting. That's an interesting idea.
I'm either A or C myself. Either I think it's after they. I think it's important that Bilbo be the savior,
the web cutter
the web cutter. Yes, the web biter. But the question then is, are the elves there by chance or benevolently, or are they sent out to get them? And I was even going towards C before. Corey turned on his influential tongue there. because to send the dwarves out on, to send the elves out on purpose almost requires another scene. I mean, it seems to me like in movie making, we'd need to see a scene where Thranduil is saying, go, my son, find them and, bring them back to me or whatever. You'd have to have a reason why they'd be out there, on purpose to capture them. So I'm thinking it's going to be a chance meeting.
But if we do get Thorin and Thranduil, and if Thorin is taken first,
yeah, that's true.
We have that occasion. Yeah. In fact, that occasion is there in the book. We don't see Thranduil ordering them out, but we do see his interrogation of Thorin, one very logical consequence of which would be Thranduil saying, okay, round up the rest of these suspicious dwarves and let's see if one of them will talk.
Right.
And besides, they're up to something and I don't know what it is, so go get them.
Yeah. Philip Lord basically says the same thing. He says it really does hinge on whether Thorin gets taken or not ahead of time.
I mean, could I imagine it happening even if that weren't the case? Yeah, I could imagine basically the elves just being aware of it, and them kind of rounding up what appear to be hostile invaders, and only maybe then discovering, oh, look, it's Thorin Oakenshield. But yeah, since I've already gone on record as at least rooting for Thorin to be captured first and have his one-on-one confrontation with Thranduil, as happens in the book, but with different dynamics, and have that conversation go presumably a very different way, since I'm already on record as cheering for that, I do think that there's plenty of occasion for the party to be sent out to capture them on purpose.
I don't know.
You're an A, Corey?
I'm leaning that way. I'm leaning. I haven't voted A in ever so long, but I am kind of leaning in that direction. I think again, it's all premised on my one perhaps improbable idea. And indeed, if Brianna has already disproved my theory that Thorin is going to be captured first, then of course my entire edifice lies in ruins. But nevertheless, I am going to stubbornly persist in it anyway. Especially since here's another one of my basic premises here, and this is a premise that I established like the first time I saw film one, and that is, I believe that what Jackson is doing and is gonna be doing with Thranduil and Thorin is essentially building on and expanding what we see happening in the books, where the Elven King and Thorin are both suspicious of each other, both have justification for their suspicion of each other, but neither one of them is really in the wrong. Both of them believe themselves to be wronged and very plausibly believe themselves to be wronged. But neither one of them is actually completely, you know, a bad guy or in the wrong. And that's, of course, one of the things which then kind of comes to its nearly tragic fulfillment at the Battle of Three Armies that almost broke out before the goblins attacked, or that was in the process of breaking out before the goblins attacked. And I suspect, I mean, again, that's my reading of what happens with Thranduil at the beginning of film one, is that there's going to be more to that story that Thorin himself does not understand. And so far, all we've been given is Thorin's own viewpoint on what Thranduil did or didn't do when Smaug attacked the mountain. So I think that there's going to be more to that story, and that it's going to end up being like that, where Thorin's feelings are totally justifiable, and you know, the Elven King's resentment of Thorin's, I presume Thorin is not going to be kind, sweet-tempered, and patient when the two of them meet. So Thorin will doubtless do some things which the Elven King, you know, which Thranduil could very well take offense at. But nevertheless, I suspect that it's going to turn out that they're both like understandable, and they're able to like come to an understanding with each other by the end of the third film. So therefore, this is why I'm rooting for Thorin to be taken, because I think that seems to me just a perfect way to build up the this kind of a situation. So anyway, let's see. Hang on, I'm just looking at.
I'm going for A.
Are you?
Yep. I think it makes more sense if the elves are out there to capture the dwarves, as opposed to just kind of wandering around. Like, I think any other reason for them to be out there would require too much on-screen explanation.
You could have tragedy. You know, you could have a tragic misunderstanding where the elves are actually going out to rescue the dwarves.
Yes.
And then, like, the dwarves, like, instead believe themselves to be under attack, or, you know, that this is, like, the next logical step in the treacherous behavior of the wood elves. Attack them back?
Can we stipulate that counts as A and B? That essentially A and B are not specific to sent to capture the dwarves, but rather B are elves.
Nope, that's C and D.
Oh, really?
That's C and D. The primary divide between A, B, and C, D is hostility from the elves.
Oh, like because...
intention to imprison.
Because C and D say, oh, okay, I see, seek them
by
benevolently.
By accident or other motivation, of which benevolence would be one.
But what if the elves are sent to, there's some dwarves wandering around in our woods, I want you to go grab them and see what they're up to. What if it's not hostility, like go and capture them so that we can imprison them? It's that Thorin Oakenshield.
And hopefully torture them afterwards.
It's just like, hey, there's some dwarves wandering around in the forest stirring up trouble. We need to take them into custody and find out what they're up to.
No, that would be A. That would count. They don't have to be malicious for A and B to be true.
Okay. All right, I'm sticking with A then. I don't think they're going to be out there to like, oh, we heard you were in trouble and we wanted to come help.
I could see it. I could totally be like, look, Thranduil is trying to do the right thing and here's Thorin spitting in his face or you know, chopping at his head with his sword. You know, I think I could see it. As it also,
I'm being the C girl here.
Since everybody seems to be leaning towards A and C and away from B and D, let me give my defense of B and D. So, okay. here's how I think that it could easily work with the elves cutting the dwarves loose from the spider silk. And that is, Bilbo could still have his moment in leading them away. Bilbo's primary action is he comes and he takes the step and he draws them away and he shouts Attercop at them. And then while he has led them away, the elves come in and rescue the dwarves. And then Bilbo comes back in time to see them like disappearing and follows them. This actually makes it a great deal easier for Bilbo to be unknown to the elves when they rescue the dwarves, because as far as they know, these dwarves who are hanging up there were the only ones who were present. So that is one way in which I could imagine the elves actually cutting them loose from the spider silk working out. But
right. I'm sticking with A.
Actually, before okay. I definitively give mine. Let me just reread this for everybody, because I did add the benevolently piece to the C and D part. So under what circumstances will the dwarves be captured by the wood elves? So A is the elves are sent out to capture the dwarves and do so after they are freed from the spider web casings. We're being very specific with that. So it's not like it's not the elves have to be dangling from the tree,
dwarves
basically.
Do. Yes. Yes.
I mean the dwarves. Yeah. B is the elves are sent out to capture the dwarves, but they have to rescue them from the spider web casings to do so. So in other words, they encounter them dangling from the tree and are actively rescued, they actively rescue them. C is the elves encounter the dwarves by chance or seek them benevolently after they are freed from the spider webs.
Yep.
And D is the elves encounter the dwarves by chance or seek them benevolently and rescue them from the spider web casings.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, so
I'm going to go with C because I think the chance. I think, and I've actually thought this for ages. Is I think that they encounter them by chance because they're actually out on their own sortie. You know how we talked about last time about the are the elves defending Mirkwood or whatever? And I think they probably send out parties of elves just to simply patrol the woods from time to time. And I think they happen on the dwarves by chance. So I'm going with C. I don't think it's benevolent. I think it's more neutral.
Big mistake.
Right.
And so I think what you said is it's going to be more like a Lothlorien gone wrong in a character.
Right. Right. And it's going to be a misunderstanding. Right. I can see, I really like the narrative of that. And Trish, that does make sense. Again, thinking back to last episode, if the elves are in a state of war with the evil in Mirkwood, they would be sending out parties to, like, there's a particularly thick spider infestation over here, or the spiders are on the warpath over here. We gotta go and beat them back. And then lo and behold, they go and beat back the spiders, and they're like, darn it, if there aren't a whole bunch of dwarves here captured by these spiders.
We have a dwarf infestation.
The spiders were bad enough. Now dwarves are cropping up. Oh boy. This neighborhood is really going to the dogs. Exactly. So that so therefore, it's not that they necessarily even encounter them just accidentally, but that they had no idea that the dwarves were there.
Right.
And
they
so
just
it's serendipity.
A lot of activity on their spider radar. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's no, Trish, you are gaining converts here. You have people swarming over to your side here. But I do. Brianna was right before you were specifying about yes, and so I do just want to repeat the divide between A, B, and C, D is not accident versus intentionality. It is intention to incarcerate or not. basically, is the division between those two. And again, one of the primary reasons that I insist on that as the division between them is, again, that is my understanding of what happened in the book, that they're being rounded up and brought in for questioning. Right. That's basically the template. And to me, the question is, are they going to depart from that? And I could see them departing from it in a couple of different ways. I do think, you know, Philip, I go back to what you were just saying a little bit ago. It does, I think, really hinge on the Thorin question. If they haven't encountered Thorin, if the first time the elves encounter or hear about the dwarves is when they're fighting the spiders and meet them, I think it's almost impossible that it could be A or B. But if they meet Thorin first, it seems to me far likelier that they would be, that it would be A or B. I could imagine it is Thorin Oakenshield, and he's really grumpy and in an understandably bad mood, but let's go rescue his people anyway. And then that's tragically misunderstood. You know, I could imagine Thranduil doing that. And possibly even actually, you know, Trish, to come back to the topic that you raised before, I could actually see the Legolas-Thranduil dynamic going in the completely opposite direction. I could see Thranduil as the one who is, like, wise and patient and saying, like, I know that Thorin is ticked off with me, but he doesn't understand and he'll come around. Let's be patient. And Legolas being, like, the hot-headed guy who's like, he's a jerk. Yeah, let's, like, whatever. We don't have anything right. to do with these dumb dwarves. And I think it was it Philip who was saying before that he would bet almost any amount of money that at some point in film 2 or 3, Legolas will deliver the line, I could never be friends with a dwarf, or something like that. I think that's probably a fairly safe bet.
Yeah, and there'll be some kind of Legolas glowing moment.
So Brianna is asking...
I do think so.
Brianna is asking, so if it is an accidental encounter, but upon seeing the dwarves, they instantly respond hostile to them, would that be intention to incarcerate? I would say no, that still is
nope.
C, because they were not sent out specifically to capture them.
That's right. In order for A or B to be true, the elves, the plan of the elves, the goal of their trip out into the forest has to be to round up and incarcerate the dwarves. Not necessarily maliciously, again, like just like for questioning or you know, it could be a sort of strong invitation rather than an imprisonment or an arrest. But whether it's an arrest or a very strong invitation, it is the goal of why they went out was to round up the dwarves and bring them back under guard.
Now, Sarah does point out that
protective custody,
even if Thorin stays with the company, right, even if Thorin does stay with the company, if the dwarves have stumbled on at least one of the elf picnics in the forest, that could prompt the elves to go and Thranduil to say, go capture the guys. So, even if Thorin stays with the company, A or B could still be happening.
True.
If they've encountered
them. If they've encountered them before, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. And Sharon points out that her daughter has told her that on the Lego set, where Toriel and Legolas, you know, are, and the spiders are in Legolas, it says Legolas must overcome the decision of his father and do what is right. That's kind of enigmatic, isn't it?
That is kind of enigmatic.
Hmm.
Well, Legolas must do what is right.
I'm not sure that helps a whole lot.
Is not very helpful.
Overcome the decision of his father and do what is right. The
decision of his father. Hmm. Well, like, that does suggest hostility on the part of Thranduil.
It does.
Or maybe it's the opposite.
I don't understand that, because...
Maybe Thranduil's caving, and Legolas is like, right. No, we got to take these dwarves out.
Standing up to the uppity dwarves is what's right.
And what is right is capturing the dwarves.
Exactly. Exactly. Let's not be rash and assume that we know what's right and wrong in this situation.
Yeah, or Philip says maybe Thranduil sent Legolas out to kill the dwarves, and Legolas has to decide to just capture them instead. Oh God, that gets into.
That's true.
But I don't see why Thranduil would be that hostile. I mean, he's the guy who left the battle, and he seemed. I always thought that the look on his face was kind of more not. It wasn't really hostile. It was more like, I'm not getting my people. This is already a lost battle. I'm not going to get my people killed for this kind of thing. So if anything, he's. I mean, I would think he. You know, why would he be hostile? If anything, I'd think he'd be. Or he's too proud to be defensive. But.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I just don't see him being like hostile. Let's go kill the dwarves or capture the dwarves or whatever.
Or the, yeah, you know, that seems hard to believe.
Oh my God,
but...
it's Thorin no longer with his Oakenshield thing, you know. And, yeah.
Right. That's true.
I could see him getting ticked off if Thorin's a butthead, you know, and Thorin, which is likely, you know, like you've said, you know.
Yeah, it certainly seems likely.
Then I could see, I mean, maybe that's, rude... you know.
I was going to say, as rude as Thorin was to Elrond, I mean, when he's just because, you know,
just
he's got
he's
pointy ears, you know, like if he's actually confronted with Thranduil himself, I mean, and how well is he going to be able to control himself? Seriously.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, really. Really. Yeah. Well, I'm going with C. I'm going to stay with C, I think. Thorin and Butthead, the new animated series. That's one of my favorite words is butthead.
So, okay.
Yeah.
I think
this is a good set of questions because actually I think all four are plausible.
Yeah, I think there'd be
assumptions.
Leaning towards A and C, but I think, of course, I'm tempted to go with B or D just to be perverse, but I won't. I think that I'm going to go with A. I think we're going to see hostility, or at least the protective custody strong invitation, which will be instantaneously interpreted by Thorin. Because I think that Thorin's, I suspect, as I said, that Thorin and Thranduil are going to be shown to, you know, in the end to realize that they've been misunderstanding each other all along, and neither one of them was really a bad guy or did anything horrible. I think that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think that Thorin's ill will towards the Wood Elves is going to receive at least an apparent confirmation or justification. And so that's why I expect.
Well,
them
I think
to
it's
be
also going
to
set up.
Prisoners.
I think it's, yeah, and I think it's also going to set up justification for Thranduil to, you know, to in film three to entertain the idea of fighting the dwarves.
Well, yeah, because I mean, keep that in mind, and then you know, this is a, as you say, this is a season three discussion, you know, in the book, with Thranduil's, you know, the Elven King setting out with an army, you know, an armed force is unjustifiable. I mean, there's no excuse for it. And there's lots of bad reasons for it. Again, it turns out to be helpful because a horde of goblins shows up, but they didn't know that, and that wasn't what they were anticipating, it seems. Thranduil marching into the Battle of Five Armies, you know, loaded for bear, seems plausible, actually, and feeling like he's got justification to
right.
take up arms against Thorin at the end. Because, you know, they can say what they like, but that's what happens. They, like, march up under arms and actively besiege Thorin and his people, even though there are only, you know, 12 of them in the mountain, well, 13 counting Bilbo in the mountain. So, I do think that we're likely to get, things are going to get chippier before they get friendlier. So I'm going with A.
By the way,
me too.
I want to just let you know that Brianna, who is one of our top scorers in round one, is going with C. So I actually stand a good chance of getting this one right.
Right, I know you're feeling very smug about that, Trish. I understand. Yes.
Hey, you know, I gotta take it where I can.
It's true. Like the implied, you know, the subtext of, you know, future
riddle discussions are all going to be like, which one of us can like convince Brianna to side with us? You know, that's going to be.
Yeah. Of course, Brianna says she's. I think she feels that she set the bar high.
That's true. You know, hey, it would be hard to maintain that level, but we'll see. You know, and we'll see. But anyway, no, I'm going with A. I'm going with A. I'm feeling good about A. I think even if Thorin doesn't get captured, as we say, I think we can still justify A. So, yeah. Okay, good. So,
Dave, you're sticking with A, right?
Yes, I am.
Yep.
We got bit a few times with the first film for not having faith that Peter Jackson would stick with the
the book. True. The book, yeah. Yeah.
Yep, it's true. You know, the whole when in doubt, guess the book answer does seem to work pretty well.
Yeah.
So, okay, good. I think that we are set. So next episode, which we will be tentatively planning for 2 weeks from now, and we'll let you know if there's any change in that. If not, be on the lookout Tuesday at 9:55. That's at 9:55 Eastern Time, and that's probably when the link will appear. So anyway,
and in the meantime, as I told the folks before we went live broadcast, Laura Burkholz and I are starting up the digest next week. That means we're actually recording a digest next week. Hopefully we'll also be out next week. So, you know, our intention is to do what Dave and I tried to do, which is sort of have a episode come out in between the main episodes so people don't go through too much withdrawal.
Yep. Excellent. Excellent. So, yeah, so next time we will look forward to, we'll do some more discussion of Thranduil, of course, as we will look at their time in the Elven King's Halls, and, of course, especially Bilbo and his sort of resident burglar position that he adopts in the Halls of the Elven King, and, of course, the barrel escape. All of these things will be fodder for next
And, Dave, I want to let you know certain people have not forgotten that there is a missing episode.
Yes, right, of course. Well,
true.
Now that I've finished my wedding website, now the little free time I have can be returned to wrapping that up. I'm almost done.
Well, the cool thing is you could also do the way I'm going to do the Mythwood proceedings and have it come out around the time that the Hobbit DVD comes out.
Yeah, that's true, too. Yeah, yeah, that was my plan all along.
Yeah, absolutely. Strategy. It's all been strategy.
Yes.
Okay, well, very good. Then I think that we will wrap up today. So thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.